This is Technical Radio, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Fax, the trade station, number 1, High Ash Farm, Caistore St Edmund, England, NR148RH.
From the Financial Times, the Committee on Televising the House sets its programme, by Peter Riddle, political editor. The Commons Select Committee, considering the televising of the House's proceedings, at last got underway yesterday afternoon, nearly 2 months after the vote in favour of a six-month experiment. It met briefly to elect Mr. John Wakeham, the leader of the Commons, as its chairman, and to discuss its programme of work, which shall start properly in mid-April. The delay in setting up the committee is because of a row about the representation of minor parties. In the early hours of yesterday morning, the committee voted by 153-35 to appoint a committee of 20, thus excluding Ulster Unionist and Welsh Nationalist MPs. The committee consists of 12 Tories, 7 Labour members, and Mr. Charles Kennedy from the Social and Liberal Democrats, including 11 who voted for the experiment and 9 against it. The original suggestion was that one of the other minority parties would be included, but the Scottish and Welsh Nationalists and Ulster Unionists pressed for 2 places. During the debate, Mr. Cranley Onslow, the chairman of the Tory backbench 1922 committee, said it was no use splitting hairs about which of the minor parties should be represented, and he urged the House to get on with the job. Mr. James Molyneux, the leader of the Unionists, said the Commons was making a mockery of its claim to be the protector of the minorities.
From The Observer. The establishment of the Peacock Committee was announced by the Tories' ill-fated Home Secretary, Leon Britton, on 18th of May 1985. Its report, published just over a year later, appeared to give the embattled BBC a reprieve. But in the war with the government, it was merely a temporary armistice, as Jeff Godfrey Hodgson explains. Enter Professor Peacock. Alan Peacock is not, as is commonly thought, a Tory, said a fellow Scot and fellow academic who knows him well. He is an old-fashioned radical liberal, and he has an almost religious belief in the efficacy of market forces. It is no reflection on the integrity of Margaret Thatcher and Leon Britton, who set it up, or of Alan Peacock and his colleagues, to say that the Peacock Committee was expected to recommend that the BBC take advertising. It did not. Instead, after a year of discussions, it arrived at a collection of recommendations which had, at first sight, little to do either with the problem it was created to solve, what to do about the licence fee, or with the solution it was generally expected to reach, which was to replace it with advertising. To use the formula beloved of Marxists, if the thesis was Margaret Thatcher's instinct that the wretched BBC would not be cured of its vices until it was made to take the plunge into the cold water of commerce, if the antithesis was that such brutal treatment would destroy the delicate life of the public services tradition, then the committee came up, not with a synthesis, with a new, lateral way of thinking about the future. The first 11 chapters of its report were drafted by the committee's secretary, on secondment from the Home Office, Bob Eagle. The conclusions and recommendations were contained in the 12th chapter, and it was over this territory that the tide of battle ebbed and flowed until you could hardly see the ground for the shell holes. 7 drafts of it were to be written, tabled, argued over, and rejected before the version finally laid before the Home Secretary on the 29th of May 1986, exactly a year after the first of the committee's 20 sessions could be agreed, or mostly agreed. The 12th chapter began by summarising the conclusions of the first 11 in a fairly cursory fashion. The BBC had run into problems because the buoyancy of its licence fee revenue, provided by the spread first of television and then of colour television, had run out. It faced cost and efficiency problems, in part because of the working of the uncomfortable duopoly with ITV. Now the duopoly was threatened by the coming of new technology, satellite, cable, video recorders. Channel 4 had brought into existence a new category of independent producers. The introduction of advertising on BBC services, the report went on blandly, was likely to depress the growth of ITV revenues, and rivalry between the BBC and ITV, if both were dependent on advertising, was likely to intensify the ratings war and so to reduce effective choice. Moreover, the technology now existed for direct subscription, that is, for viewers to pay for what they wanted to watch. And polls showed that people would be willing to pay in that way. The fundamental aim of broadcasting policy, the committee pronounced, should, in our view, be to enlarge both the freedom of choice of the consumer and the opportunities available to programme makers to offer alternative wares to the public. What the committee was expounding, it was clear, was not undiluted commercialism, but something very different. The committee even sketched out its own concept of public service broadcasting. Of course, Peacock interpreted the public service ideal in a far narrower way than the BBC's tradition, or indeed the IBA tradition, does. In the Peacock version, public money should be spent on broadcasting only for specific worthy causes. For the rest of its role as a medium of entertainment, television should be supported by the market. This is not, however, a pure market philosophy. The committee itself stressed that its view of the aim of broadcasting, with its emphasis on reflecting the tastes and preferences of consumers, should not be confused with commercial laissez-faire or with privatisation. Many of those who sought to defend the BBC against the government's attack assumed that the Prime Minister's intention was to bring British television more or less into line with the American model. But Peacock rejected it absolutely, even, so far as a blue book ever expresses such emotions, contemptuously. Something like the present system, it argued, actually simulated a market designed to reflect what the consumers want better than laissez-faire does. Only, once the technology makes direct payment and multiple channels possible, is something better than the present system feasible. What is that better way? After systematically clearing away alternative models and philosophies and explaining the premises of its thinking, Peacock's Chapter 12 at last laid out the committee's own preference. British broadcasting, it proclaimed, should move towards a sophisticated market system based on consumer sovereignty. The Peacock plan envisaged three stages. In stage one, until well into the 1990s, the bulk of broadcast television would come from the two BBC and two ITV channels, plus a couple of supplementary channels formed by using the silent hours. Satellite and cable television would develop, but most viewers and listeners would rely on the BBC, ITV and independent local radio. In stage two, there would be a proliferation of broadcasting systems, channels and methods of payment, but subscription would replace the main part of the licence fee. And in stage three, we shall all meet in the suite by and by. There would then be an indefinite number of channels, with a free choice between pay per programme and pay as you view. Technology, the committee hoped, would reduce the cost of this multiplicity of outlets in a free broadcasting market. To summarise then, the Peacock Committee surprised many observers, probably including the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary who set it up, by not recommending that the BBC be obliged to finance itself from advertising. Instead, it prescribed a long-term strategy of liberalisation, in the course of which the BBC would gradually shrink from being one half of a duopoly, roughly equivalent to all the ITV companies in size, to something not much more than a British equivalent of the American public broadcasting system. Peacock offered, in effect, the prospect of death by strangulation as an alternative to the short, sharp chop. How did the committee get from its presumed purpose, to make the BBC take advertising, to this complex and, in some respects, idiosyncratic strategy of its own. It is, of course, the story of the internal chemistry of the committee's membership. The press understandably reports the membership of a committee like Peacock in terms of stereotypes. To say that someone is a journalist, for example, or a lawyer, or a woman, is thought to predict what that person's views will be. In something like those crude terms, here were the members of the Peacock Committee. Alan Peacock, a free market economist and authority on finance. Samuel Britton, journalist and free market economist. Judith Chalmers, BBC television journalist. Jeremy Hardy, accountant and social democrat. Alastair Hetherington, journalist and former BBC executive. Lord Quinton, philosopher and conservative. Sir Peter Reynolds, industrialist. A safe majority, you might think, for making the BBC take advertising. But, of course, it didn't work out like that at all. Why did the committee turn down advertising on the BBC? We decided at a fairly early stage, Lord Quinton remembers, that we wouldn't let ourselves be unduly bound by the terms of reference, on the simple ground that it wasn't possible to be so bound. In order to justify the conclusion that you couldn't conjure another £900 million a year out of advertising market without the most seismic consequences, one had to consider the style of financing of the independent sector. Alastair Hetherington thinks the most influential member of the committee on this point may well have been Sir Peter Reynolds. Alan Peacock has an almost religious belief in the efficacy of market forces. He makes millions for his company by the successful application of market forces. So it seemed to me that Alan Peacock deferred to Peter Reynolds in a way that he deferred to nobody else, not even to Samuel Britton, for whom he had a great respect. And when eventually, in mid-February, Peter Reynolds said, "Advertising on BBC One is not on. It's going to do too much damage," that was the end of it. The first reaction of many BBC people to the Peacock report was simply a sigh of relief. That was premature. The corporation was to be spared what many regarded as the supreme indignity of accepting advertising. That was about all it was to be spared.
We're on the air to demonstrate the kind of service we will be providing every day of the week, starting during the summer. What we are seeking is a licence to transmit from the United Kingdom, instead of hiring transmission facilities abroad. If you would like our specially printed QSL card, please send 50 pence in British stamps or 3 international reply coupons to Radio Fax, number 1, High Ash Farm, Case Store St Edmund, England, NR14 8RH. And don't forget that every letter we receive helps our application for a licence to transmit from England.
From Broadcast Systems Engineering, The Herd Programme by Quentin Howard. The googly delivered by Home Secretary Douglas Hurd's common written reply in January set everyone in the radio industry wondering just how to hit the ball back. After floated ideas of last year's green paper, Radio Choices and Opportunities, most broadcasters were confident that some of the more peculiar notions would have been straightened out by the opinions of the 5,000 contributors who put in their 4 pennyworth to the Home Office in response. The Home Secretary's announcement made it clear that he favoured selling off the 3 Plum National channels in a sealed bid contest, that current independent local radio stations could throw off the shackles of IBA constraints, and community radio would mushroom up with 300 stations. More significantly, a new radio authority would be set up to administer these new stations with a light touch. It was this particular intent which prompted a speedy response from the IBA director, General George Whiteney, who regretted the government's announcement and said that the IBA was best placed in terms of experience and skills to bring into being both community and INR stations. Suddenly, it seemed that the great new radio future was going to be more complicated than anticipated. In recent years, the IBA has managed to improve its cost effectiveness, particularly in engineering, but perhaps the damage has already been done and the vociferous lobby from ILR contractors for greater self-determination and control of its transmitters found a sympathetic ear in Whitehall. The new radio authority will probably be a hived-off core of the IBA's current radio division. If not, it begs the question, where will the experience of 15 years of commercial radio administration come from overnight? There is a massive potential for ineptitude and blunder from a novice authority in setting up hundreds of new stations, regardless of the amount of touch, with any learning curve, as if there is an opportunity to jump on halfway up, you don't start at the bottom. To create at least 3 national commercial radio stations, the proposal is to wrest 2 medium wave channels from the BBC and use the INR FM allocation for the third. It is hard to conceive one serious bidder, let alone 2, wanting to open a brand new service on the BBC's reject frequencies, which do not cover the nation fully by day and are a waste of electricity by night. The single FM channel faces equal problems, as it will find difficulty competing with BBC network services like for like, and really needs a second national commercial channel on FM to give the listener a better choice of high quality listening and therefore opportunity. The 300 or so community stations are to be set up according to local needs and demands. Whilst no one would argue about the necessity of radio small town or radio rural, the real bloodbath will be fought over the definition and perceived need of highly profitable narrow music policy stations in large cities, capable of generating large revenues and justifying it with an ethnic tag. Just as local independent radio stations are learning to be profitable by combining these new proposals, fix an ownership limit of 1 national or 6 local stations in a group, restricting the growth and pulling up the rug from under the hopeful plans of every major station. This long-awaited step in the new radio bill has caught everyone in one way or another and leaves the industry in a temporary limbo. The IBA had just begun to offer new franchises again, with a clutch of important holes in the network map coming up over the summer months, and now it seems pointless to continue with a set of rules which will be different by the time these new franchises start. Some ILR stations have announced plans to split FM and AM broadcasting to provide diversity. But with a six-station limit imposed, splitting suddenly becomes less attractive, particularly if it means reducing territory. Whilst there may be genuine fears about conglomerate stations getting too large, the trend has made ILR profitable and marketable for the first time in its history. New stations are to be free to make their own transmitting arrangements, which heralds a radical departure for British broadcasting and opens a regulatory can of worms at the same time. The intention is to move towards a freer system, such as in the USA, but the difference is here is that we have no direct equivalent of the FCC to control it. So, as Douglas Hurd's ball comes bouncing down the wicket, we must all await the outcome and trust there will be runs aplenty. It certainly isn't a no ball, but it could be a wide. And the trouble is, the bowler is also the umpire in this game. Let's hope we're not playing for the Ashes.
For those who are not around during the week or whose time switch recording failed, here is this week's Media Network from Radio Netherlands.
By shortwave and satellite, this is Radio Netherlands. Media Network, a weekly survey of international communication developments, produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Right, hang on to your headphones, as a lot of last-minute news came in over the past few hours, which has changed our publicised lineup this week. We'll start for a change with listening suggestions. Hans van den Boogert in Veldhoven here in Holland reports that Radio Télévision Marocain in Morocco has started relaying its international network on shortwave. Most of it is in French, and Hans has had programmes from Rabat between 14 and 17 hours UTC on the frequency of 17.595 kHz. At 17 hours, they switched to 17.815 kHz until 19 hours, and then they moved to 11.920 kHz for programmes right up until 01 hours UTC. The BBC Monitoring Service adds that English programmes from Morocco also form part of this new international service shortwave relay, and they're heard between 16.30 and 18 hours UTC, Mondays to Fridays. Saturdays, the block is later between 17 and 18 hours UTC, and on Sundays, later still, between 19 and 20 hours UTC. Well, at 16.30 UTC yesterday on 17.595 kHz, we found two stations broadcasting in English on top of each other, the BRT in Belgium and Morocco. Have a listen.
The country's highest traditional
publishing company,
owner of the Liberal
Headlines
newspaper.
Official visit tomorrow.
Half an hour later at 17 hours UTC, both stations leave 17.595, and it all goes quiet. There's shortwave logic for you. Despite the recent accord between the Nicaraguan government and the Contras, due to start on April the 1st, the US-backed Contra forces have no plans to discontinue their clandestine radio station. Radio Liberación, believed to be coming from the southern part of El Salvador, continues to operate. And a spokesman for the United Nicaraguan Opposition in Washington, D.C., told us yesterday they won't stop broadcasting towards Managua on medium wave just yet.
Not yet. I mean, depends what happened after 60 days, I will say.
To Europe, and the British Super Channel satellite TV service has approached its main rival, Sky, with a view to a merger.
Sky Channel told us they're still studying the proposal, but no firm decision is expected very shortly. Both Super and Sky Channel have failed to make any money as yet, although Sky has always claimed that it takes a long time to make a profit in pan-European television. Sky, in fact, has just started an experimental breakfast programme in Swedish. When we switched on this morning at 04:30 UTC, they were doing some extensive morning exercises.
1, 2, 3, och åtta fåtöljerna.
Ja, hej allihop! Nu är det dags för morgonjumpa med oss här från Fisket och Bettis. Och alla kan vara med, du också.
All that at 6:30 a.m. local time. Well, now to the United States, where the Navy has decided to move its relocatable shortwave over-the-horizon radar system to the Aleutian Islands. That's near the Alaskan mainland. In the course of 1989, the experimental radar system will move from its current site in White House, Virginia, to Amchitka Island. Meanwhile, the U.S. Air Force has a shortwave over-the-horizon radar system up in Maine, in the northeast corner of the U.S. Extensive tests of that system were made in January. Judging from monitoring reports, it seems to have performed without causing major interference problems to shortwave broadcasters. Ever since the Russian over-the-horizon radar system caused severe reception problems during its operation a few years back, concern has been expressed that these radars should find a modulation system that makes it compatible with other spectrum users.
Hey, hey, you!
Media Network's Car Radio Investigation.
Joining me for this part of the program is Pete Myers, because we often get questions as to whether there's a good car radio on the world market that has shortwave capability. The answer, in my humble opinion, seems to be not yet. A few years back, you could buy a shortwave converter from either the companies of Grundig or Becker, both West German, which you fitted between the car antenna and a standard car radio with a medium wave AM band. By pressing a button on the converter box, reception of medium wave was suddenly transformed into shortwave reception of, let's say, the 31-meter band. The converter has long since been discontinued. Grundig told us yesterday they have no plans to put such a device on the market again, and you'd be hard-pushed to find one on the second-hand market.
The converter device did a reasonable job, but tuning the dial was more by feel than anything else. You had to know by heart that Radio Netherlands was down the bottom end of the 49-meter band, and little bit to the right was the BBC and so on. Not much use to a novice. In addition, the placing of the car radio antenna was crucial. Put it too near the engine, and the radiation from either the mechanical or electronic ignition system drowned out all but the stronger shortwave broadcast signals.
The myth that shortwave on car radios is widely available in Europe seems to persist. If you have about $2,000, you can indeed buy one top model from each of Becker, Blaupunkt or Grundig that covers shortwave of sorts. Two of the receivers cover the official 49-meter band only, whilst the Grundig does cover from 5.9 to 9.9 megahertz. But that's a lot to pay for what's only a mediocre shortwave section in the set. Clearly the money in the top-range receivers goes into the FM reception and fancy tuning aids.
About 4 years ago, the Dutch Philips company launched their AC739 car radio stereo cassette player. This was much cheaper and offered two shortwave bands in addition to medium wave and FM. One band covers 3.5 to 12 megahertz and the other 12 to 22 megahertz continuously. But the single conversion set has only fair shortwave performance. The backlash on the tuning knob makes tuning somewhat haphazard. A lot of stations are crammed into a little space, and you could cause a nasty accident if you try to tune the receiver while driving at high speeds. Jamming and Morse interference leap out at you and can startle if you're not prepared for it. The set is still sold by Philips in Holland for $341. The trouble is, the purchaser isn't given much help as to what they can do with these two shortwave bands on the car radio. Even the current catalogue incorrectly informs the customer that the unit is designed to pick up wavelengths of between 13 and 75 millimetres.
So it was with interest at the end of January that the Japanese company of Kenwood launched their RZ1 wideband receiver onto the European market. This would cover continuously from 500 kilohertz way up to 905 megahertz. So that's medium wave, shortwave, VHF, and way up beyond the UHF television bands here in Europe. We waited a few weeks and then went out and purchased an off-the-shelf sample at a shop in Utrecht. The price was 14.99 guilders, which is $832 at today's exchange rate.
Inside the foam packaging is an extremely light, compact, black-coloured receiver. It weighs 1,500 grams and looks exactly like a car radio. In fact, it will fit inside the standard hole drilled in the dashboard of most automobiles. If you do that, though, you'll end up with a tinny, muffled sound of less than 1.5 watts. The small speaker is mounted on the top of the set, and sliding it into a car radio rack, of course, prevents the sound from coming out. Kenwood sell a small mobile speaker to mount on top of the dashboard, but if you're driving at anything above 20 miles an hour in a standard car, the noise of the engine drowns out the mere 2 watts of audio power from the RZ1. If you're going to seriously use this receiver for mobile use, you'll have to use a car hi-fi booster amplifier. That's no problem, because on the back of the RZ1 are two phono connectors designed exactly for that purpose. Included with the instruction booklet are 4 plastic feet, so if you want the receiver to sit on top of a table, either at home or maybe on board a boat, that can be done. You need to find a 12-volt DC power supply from somewhere. The unit consumes just under 1 ampere of current when it's on, so a mains power unit or a car battery are essential. You can forget about trying to bank on penlight cells. That wouldn't last an hour.
Let's have a look at the front of the receiver. It's quite neat and uncomplicated. There's a rotary tuning knob, which has 24 steps per revolution, and which you can twist without banging your fingers on nearby control knobs. There's an on-off control, a squelch, and a row of buttons marked from 0 to 9. You can use these keys to directly enter a chosen frequency. And each time you press a key, the set beeps at you. The higher the number, the higher the bleep. So, how did the set perform below 30 megahertz?
Well, I'm afraid that despite its dual conversion circuitry, shortwave and medium wave performance on the RZ1 is simply disastrous. Using a simple car telescopic antenna mounted on the rear of the vehicle, we drove out into the countryside, some 60 miles from any medium wave transmitters. Parked by the side of the road, we tapped in 9410 kilohertz onto a shortwave portable receiver costing about $200. The BBC was coming in fairly weak, but readable.
And he swims to his beloved and climbs up on the balcony.
But while it is easy to be captured by the romantic quests of Lord Byron...
That was on a portable, with the whip antenna poking out of the window. So what did the same signal sound like on the RZ1? Well, the easy-to-read WAC display shows the same frequency, 9410 kilohertz, so let's turn up the volume. As you can hear, it's unusable. The rotary tuning knob moves the receiver frequency in 5 kilohertz steps on medium and shortwave. There is no fine-tuning control that you'd expect on any communications receiver.
The dynamic selectivity of the single intermediate frequency filter is so mediocre that if I select Swiss Radio International on 3975 kilohertz... Well, there they are, and now I move 5 kilohertz away. As you can hear, side splatter all over the Voice of Germany on nearby 3980 kilohertz. Between 3 and 30 megahertz, the RZ1 has a very high background noise, this being mainly due to medium wave mixing products. If you tune the medium wave band at dusk, then apart from 2 strong clear signals around here, the rest of the band is filled with mush and distortion.
The RZ1 may be called a wideband receiver, but you'd expect it to select stations one at a time, not all at once.
There is an attenuator to reduce the signal level coming into the receiver, and this helps slightly. But because they've put it at the back of the receiver, you can't reach the attenuator switch if you put the RZ1 in the dashboard of a car. The brochure indicates the receiver would be useful on a boat. Well, as it has both AM plus narrow and wideband FM modes, you could certainly use it to monitor local VHF traffic. But there is no single sideband on the RZ1, and undesirable second and third order harmonic products from the medium wave band obliterate most signals on the marine band above 1.8 megahertz anyway. For the shortwave broadcast and utility listener, you can get significantly better performance than this on a communications receiver costing two-thirds the price.
Mind you, the RZ1 covers frequencies well beyond the shortwave band. If you connect a wideband disc cone antenna, then you can start searching out the aircraft, utility, and even FM broadcast stations. You can even listen to FM in stereo via the external amplifier. But then, any car radio will do that too. 100 memories are offered, together with four tuning rates of 5, 12.5, 20 and 25 kilohertz. These facilities are vital if you're scanning the huge areas above 100 megahertz for local signals. A unique feature is the ability to mark certain frequencies with up to 7 letters or numbers, so that when they come up, you can actually see on the display your previously programmed identification. Performance on VHF and UHF is considerably better than shortwave, but it doesn't match the specifications of either the FRG 9600 from Yaesu or the ICOM ICR 7000, which are the main competing wideband receivers on the market.
To summarize, as far as the shortwave listener is concerned, the Kenwood RZ1 is definitely not a good choice. The luxury of having a radio in the car that gives you the entire shortwave band with digital readout is not matched by the performance or the price. Any cheap car radio will produce less distortion on medium wave than the 15% total harmonic distortion that we measured on the RZ1. You can also opt for a set with a cassette player too.
If you're looking for a VHF-UHF scanner, then check the competition. The RZ1 clearly covers a wider part of the spectrum at the expense of performance.
Kenwood have a justifiably good reputation in the field of communications receivers. Their R2000 and 5000 models are deservedly popular. But the RZ1 is a terrible disappointment.
Curiously, although the brochures talk about a US version with an NTSC decoder for television monitoring, Kenwood USA Corporation say they don't plan to market the RZ1 in the United States.
Radio Netherlands. It's hard for us to lose our identity.
And now it's time for a change of subject.
A few weeks back, we carried an item on possible, and I stress possible, links between non-ionizing radiation and certain types of skin cancer. Louis Lessin, editor of the New York-based Microwave News, has now sent us this follow-up.
An abnormally high rate of childhood cancer has been documented in the small agricultural town of McFarland in Kern County, Southern California. But despite years of intense study, health officials have been unable to identify the cause of the cancer cluster. Investigators had focused almost exclusively on chemical pollutants in the area without success. Nor can they explain why McFarland is different from the dozens of similar farming towns spread throughout the San Joaquin Valley. A number of experts, as well as some McFarland residents, now believe that the high-power Voice of America shortwave transmitter in nearby Delano may play a role in the cause of the cluster. The Delano VOA station, which is approximately 4 miles from the town of McFarland, has transmitters with nearly 2 million watts in total output, broadcasting radio programs to Asia and to Latin America. Three 250-kilowatt transmitters are used to broadcast southeast to Central and South America at 9 and 11 megahertz for approximately 4 hours each day, beaming programs directly over the nearby town. In a recent report on the cancer cluster, the California Department of Health Services states that it could not establish a link between any specific factor and development of the cancers. The state discounts the possible impact of radio frequency radiation. Quote, we don't think that the evidence that we looked at points in the direction of non-ionizing radiation as a problem at all, said Mr. Raymond Nutra, the head of the state health department's epidemiological studies and surveillance section. On the other hand, Dr. Ross Adie, associate chief of staff for research and development at the Veterans Medical Center in Loma Linda, California, is not so sure. He has been following the McFarland investigation with keen interest and believes it is possible that the VOA radiation could have an effect. He points to the fact that there are no animal or human studies related to prolonged intermittent exposures at these levels. Other experts have raised the possibility of a connection between toxic chemicals stored near McFarland and the non-ionizing shortwave radiation in the air. Laboratory studies indicate that microwaves can enhance the carcinogenity of certain chemical compounds. Work in California by Dr. William Fletcher has shown that weakly modulated radio frequency fields can significantly enhance chemical cancer promoters. Together, they disrupt communications between human cells through gap junctions. These findings are consistent with modern cancer models, which emphasize that this type of disruption leads to unregulated cell growth. However, it's very important to put this finding into perspective. We are exposed to all kinds of environmental health hazards in everyday life, even the ultraviolet radiation from the sun, which some people go to the beach to try and absorb. In the case of non-ionizing, low-level radiation from transmitter sites, a lot more research needs to be done. Those in this field of cancer studies are not trying to create mass hysteria. They're trying to ensure that sufficient scientific research is done in order to draw firm safety recommendations.
Radio Netherlands, the original international local radio station.
Now, joining me on a line from Vienna is Wolf Harrod. For a few weeks ago, we looked at Anglophone local radio in the south of France. Now, Austria, it seems, will license some private commercial local radio in 1989.
Yes, indeed, Jonathan. Probably beginning next year, Austria too will introduce private radio. As usual, this is due to a political decision, and some people get mixed feelings about it. Let's consider the facts. At a first glance, Austria, with its population of 7.5 million, seems to provide a good marketplace for commercial radio, for quite a lot of stations. But then, almost a third of our population is concentrated in the eastern part of the country, around Vienna, the national capital. This area might easily be covered with a few powerful FM transmitters. The central and western parts, however, are not only mountainous and thus quite difficult to be fully covered, they are also relatively sparsely populated. Local stations could hardly survive. You need regional cooperation to get financially off the ground. Moreover, ORF, the national radio, provides already a full range of programs. Take Vienna, for example. Here we get the cultural channel Österreich 1, the regional programs of between 3 and 5 provinces. There are 9 altogether, one for each province. And Ö3, the pop music channel, which in 5 of the 9 provinces provides additional local program windows. Finally, there is Blue Danube Radio in English, French and Spanish.
To these 8 programs, you might add Radio Melodia, a middle-of-the-road music station in FM stereo from Czechoslovakia, Radio Danubius, the Hungarian holiday station in German, and Kossuth Radio Budapest with lots of good music, again in FM stereo. The situation is similar in the western parts of Austria, where a couple of German and Swiss ARD and private stations can be received. The Taos is a main target area for private stations from Italy. Radio Uno, to mention just one, provides 3 different channels in German, and there are stations from Yugoslavia as well. Audiences to all these cross-border programs are relatively small, even though Austrian private stations will meet heavy competition. Now let's take up another politically more important aspect. We have already one of Europe's strongest concentrations in the print media, with 2 dominating daily newspapers, the Kronenzeitung and Kurier.
Between them, they share almost 70% of total audience. They and a few others with less circulation have now established a company to start Radio Print. The second largest concentration is in the south, where the three leading papers plan to introduce a station called Private Radio Carinthia. Now, it is widely feared that the political influence of only a few mass circulation papers might extend to the electronic media. No politician, it is argued, would then really dare to risk their unfavorable comments. The influence of the fourth establishment, critics say, will simply be far too strong. Okay, let's wait and see. Meanwhile, we have a minor sensation here in Vienna. Since October last year, a political pirate radio station, critical to the government and the social situation in the Republic, hit the airwaves. It took the authorities half a year to get hold of the transmitters of these pirates, or so they thought. Only a fortnight after final victory was announced, Radio Widerstand, or Radio Resistance, operated again on 103.3.
Radio Widerstand.
Radio Widerstand.
A fortnight ago, their programs lasted for more than an hour and provoked authorities challenging the ORF and the postal authorities to confiscate their transmitter, which they did. Listen to the sudden end following Radio Widerstand's friendly invitation and Kossuth Radio popping up again on the frequency.
Für den schnellsten Postfuchs gibt es heute einen uralt UKW-Sender zu gewinnen. Diesen Veteran der freien Radiobewegung stellen wir gerne dem Postmuseum zur Verfügung.
Bis es soweit ist, hören Sie heute die Wiederholung unserer Sendung vom letzten Freitag.
Radio Widerstand.
But a week later only, this Friday, the station was back again and promised to continue for the weeks to come.
Kleines Nachtgespräch über den Dächern Wiens.
Siehst du den Mond über Wien, Loisel?
Ja, Franz, aber den seht ihr nicht. Leicht einmal ohne.
And if my German is still any good, in that last interview they simply say they can see the moon above Vienna, but not the transmitter.
Africa Media News Desk.
And back on the line from Southern Africa is Richard Jinby.
The big news from Southwest Africa and Namibia is that the long-awaited evening transmissions of the SWABC's national service get underway on April the 5th. There will be two channels in operation between 1930 and 2100 hours UTC. That's 1930 and 2100. As far as shortwave is concerned, Channel 1, the educational and cultural service, will be carried on 3290 kHz, 3290, as well as medium wave 594 and 737 kHz. The entertainment service, Channel 2, will go out on 3270 kHz. At 2100, the two stations combine for the all-night service through until 0400 the next day, Sundays 0500. Turning to Angola, Radio Nacional in Luanda can now be heard on both 4820 and 4953. 4820 takes the B program and 4953 the A program. The Lubango regional station has two channels in operation, both on medium wave. 1232 kHz carries programs in vernaculars and 1313 kHz relays Luanda's A program. The clandestine station, A Voz de Resistencia do Galo Negro, operated on behalf of UNITA, has dropped their A channel, probably as a result of technical problems. Normally it is on 11980 and 15167 kHz. Those frequencies again, 11980 and 15167, from 0800 to 1000 and 1200 to 1400 hours.
Ke tsoro mo sa botswana mo no sa borune
Radio Botswana has dropped 7255 kilohertz. This, I think, is because of problems at the transmitter. Until it went off the air, the signal had deteriorated badly. In Botswana, Radio Bop and Radio Mobatu are now 24 hours a day. Radio Bop is on medium wave, 1098 kilohertz. And lastly, Radio Mozambique has returned to 15295 kilohertz, where they heard around 0800 to 1500 hours. The frequency still varies somewhat, up to 4 kilohertz either side, and is poorly modulated.
Right, well, thanks there to Richard Jinby.
The current propagation forecast is next from Media Network.
I'm afraid we're having communications problems reaching Mike Bird in Melbourne, Australia for this week's complete survey, but I can tell you that the current solar flux is 129 and the O-index is active at a figure of 25. That means the conditions on the higher frequencies around 15 and 17 megahertz are disturbed. So it might be an idea to check for signals on the tropical bands of 60 and 90 meters for signals from the tropical regions of the world. These are less affected by the active geomagnetic activity. Last Saturday, there was a severe disturbance to transatlantic communications on shortwave here in Europe, but at the same time, paths to Asia opened up. The English broadcast from the Sri Lanka Broadcasting Corporation in Colombo, for instance, came booming through between 1745 and 1815 UTC on 11800 kilohertz. The outlook, it seems, over the Easter weekend is for continued low solar activity, but, I'm afraid, more disturbed geomagnetic activity. And finally, on this last day of March, an update on a non-appearance. We've been getting a lot of phone calls asking about the much-publicised 1988 International Listening Handbook, to be published by Bent Friedewald in West Germany. We were led to believe that it would be available at the end of this month. Well, nothing came in the post this morning, so we're left wondering, like many others, just what's going on. That's it for now. Join me on Easter Monday for our science review, the research fair, and for the moment, have a peaceful weekend.
That was Media Network from Radio Netherlands, produced and introduced by Jonathan Marks. Innovative information-based radio, broadcasting to the European community, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Fax, the trade station. Number 1, High Ash Farm, Caistor St. Edmund, England, NR148RH.
From this week's Independent, Stars, Moon and Planets in April by Heather Cooper and Nigel Henbest. Beauty shrouded in a cloud of poison. On the 3rd of April, Venus reaches its greatest apparent distance from the Sun, shining in western skies like a small lantern until after midnight. After the Sun and Moon, it is the brightest object in the sky, but most of all, Venus is undeniably beautiful. It is the closest of the planets to Earth, and in size and mass, very nearly its twin. The second planet out, it lies 108 million kilometres from the Sun, about 70% of Earth's distance. Only 30 years ago, astronomers were asking, is Venus a warmer version of our own planet, one that could support life? The first hints that all might not be rosy came in the mid-1950s, when pioneer radio astronomers picked up signals which suggested that Venus had a searingly high surface temperature. In 1962, they discovered that Venus spins backwards and that its 243-day-long day is actually longer than its 225-day-long year. The Soviets launched space probes, all of which stopped transmitting before reaching the surface, crushed by the pressure of Venus's atmosphere. By the time the first heavily armoured Soviet probe, Venera 7, touched down on the planet's surface in 1970, everyone was prepared for the worst. Venus's atmospheric pressure was 90 times that of Earth's, the same as that experienced by a submarine 500 fathoms down. The atmosphere itself was made of unbreathable carbon dioxide gas with floating clouds of sulfuric acid. Venus's surface temperature turned out to be higher than the top setting of a domestic cooker, a searing 470 degrees centigrade. Subsequent probes have confirmed this grim picture. Maps made by bouncing penetrating radar waves off the surface reveal a flat, featureless land with only a few lower-lying basins. There are only three major highland areas, of which the highest, Aphrodite, is roughly comparable in size with Africa. Ishtar, the size of Australia, contains Venus's highest mountain, the 11-kilometre-high Maxwell Montes, while Beta Regio appears to consist of a pair of enormous volcanoes. A recent proposal by scientists at the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, Ames Research Center in California, maintains that the Earth and Venus were in fact very similar for the first few hundred million years of their lives. Both planets were covered in vast oceans, but while Earth's oceans remained cool, Venus's oceans were so warm that they began to evaporate. Like glass in a greenhouse, the water vapour trapped even more of the sun's heat, while at the same time, the atmospheric pressure started to build. Before long, Venus became a planet-sized pressure cooker. As steam escaped into space, more water boiled off from the oceans into the atmosphere. Eventually, the oceans boiled dry. The greenhouse now baked the bare rocks, liberating carbon dioxide gas into the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is even more efficient at trapping heat from the sun, and this enhanced the greenhouse effect. Venus's fate has lessons for us too. Our continued burning of fossil fuels has liberated vast quantities of carbon dioxide gas into our atmosphere. Two independent studies conducted in the USA have revealed that Earth's temperature is rising as a result. Climatologists warn of a 3 to 10 degrees centigrade rise in global temperature over the next century. American scientists are preparing to mount an ambitious mission to the planet as soon as the space shuttle is ready. The launch is scheduled for next year. The principal instrument on board will be a radio mapper, which will pierce the cloud cover and reveal details as narrow as the Thames. Scientists hope to map between 70 to 90% of the planet, looking for signs that former oceans once existed. They will also be looking for any indications that life ever gained a foothold in Venus's mysterious watery past.
From Electronics and Wireless World, Mobile Radio Spectrum Woes by Pat Hawker. Some 5 years ago, the Merriman Committee recommended that the UK should cease television broadcasting in VHF bands 1 and 3, thus overturning the long-established expectation stemming from the now-defunct Television Advisory Committee that these bands would be re-engineered for 625 line television. The government quickly accepted the Merriman proposal that these bands would be largely transferred to the land mobile services, apparently promising them even more spectrum space than they had been seeking over many years. For at least 25 years, the land mobile services had felt unfairly starved of spectrum. That neighbouring countries still regard bands 1 and 3 as prime bands for television seemed relatively unimportant, while the muted response of the British broadcasting authorities to being ousted from VHF may well have been connected with their early 1980s fear of cable and their ambitions to get into space broadcasting in spite of many warnings of the financial risks of both. Be that as it may, the mobile industry's drive into bands 1 and 3 has been far from smooth, resulting in much grumbling about delays, ambiguities, uncertainties, and system standards. Rakel Vodafone, for example, still believes that an acute shortage of suitable mobile equipment due to protracted disputes over standards and patents is strangling the putative Band 3 network. Cliff Dadson, chairman of the Network Operators Committee, Band 3, has bitterly attacked the DTI/Home Office announcement that consideration is being given to possible limited use of bands 1 and 3 for additional terrestrial television services, thus apparently reversing Merriman. On behalf of the committee, he claims that the government is acting in an outrageous and irresponsible manner. The committee has written to the DTI, pointing out that the members of this committee have been working closely with your department for the past 5 or 6 years, overcoming the problems, both political and technical, of sharing radio spectrum between the private mobile radio, PMR services in this country, with television services on the continent and in Ireland. Just as we are going into operation with these new services, the government issues a statement which completely undermines the industry's confidence in the department to give it the support which had been promised. Presumably, the broadcasting services have brought pressure to bear upon the government to extend the present studies. If the government cannot withstand such an approach, what hope has the less influential operator of radio services when deregulation comes into being? I must insist that as far as Band 3 studies are concerned, my committee must be involved. We will activate every means at our disposal to protect our investment and our future business in Band 3. The anger of the committee is understandable, but in one respect possibly off target. The suggestion of reallocating frequency Band 3 to television came not from the existing broadcasters, who have shown little enthusiasm for more competing terrestrial channels, but from the 214-page report on subscription television prepared for the DTI by Dr. Charles Johnshire of CSPI. Most viewers in Britain are equipped to receive UHF channels in the gap between bands 4 and 5, but not for VHF television. And also from Lineup magazine, bands 1 and 3 for Channel 5? The Department of Trade and Industry and the Home Office are extending the current studies on extra television networks using UHF and microwave distribution to include VHF bands 1 and 3. Bands 1 and 3, which were used for 405 line television, are still available under international agreements for television and are used for this in many countries. In the UK, however, they are now used largely for business mobile radio. This remains government policy, but it has been suggested that a limited broadcasting service could share this spectrum with mobile radio, and the government is extending the existing UHF study to consider this. The original feasibility study started in October. It aimed to address the technical and financial prospects for both microwave distribution and a fifth UHF network. The DTI says the purpose of the studies is to equip the government with an up-to-date and authoritative assessment of the technical options. And now to Roger Tate.
Thank you. Well, DAT, or digital audio tape, is one of those subjects that just won't lie down. In the summer of last year, like many journalists, I was talking about digital audio tape and discussing how it might make CD obsolete overnight. In fact, here's an excerpt from a BBC programme called Waveguide.
A few weeks ago, you may have heard us talking about a new way of recording sound. It's called digital audio tape. And some people have said it's going to revolutionise the sound recording industry. In particular, companies making compact discs, it's been prophesied, could be driven out of business. Well, today we're not just going to talk about DAT, we're going to have a demonstration. Audio journalist Bob Tomalski has brought in several large and impressive-looking boxes of gear. Bob, what are they?
Well, I've brought in to the studio two digital audio tape recorders, one from Technics called the SVD-1000 and one from Sony called the DTC-1000. The machines use these DAT tapes, and really the technology is borrowed from video. They're about half the size of a conventional audio cassette, totally sealed. In fact, the tape runs in the machine extremely slowly, just the same as on a video machine, about 8 millimetres per second. But the actual machine has got a rotary recording head that whizzes round at a terrific speed, in fact, about 2,000 revolutions per minute. Let's actually put the tape in the machine and see what happens. I'm opening the drawer on the machine and putting the tape in and closing the machine. Instantly, the clock on the machine tells us that we're, in fact, a few seconds into the tape and that we're on track number one. And I'm going to push play. And the sound quality is very similar to that of CD.
So, like many hi-fi fans, I was full of enthusiasm for the new format. But here we are, almost a year since DAT was released in Japan, and the machines are still not officially imported into Europe. In September of last year, Sony announced that DAT would be released by October, hoping that other hi-fi manufacturers would follow suit. October came, and a consignment of DTC-1000s duly arrived in bonded warehouses in Slough, near London. But would Sony actually release them? No, they were waiting for Panasonic, Hitachi, Pioneer, JVC, and all the other Japanese manufacturers to follow suit. Now, the problem at that time was that CBS Records in the United States were lobbying for a complete prohibition of DAT recorders that were not fitted with a CBS invention called copy code. Copy code is a method of disabling the record circuitry of a DAT machine whenever it senses a CD, or for that matter any recorded material that has been passed through a special notch filter. Now, hi-fi journalists claimed that the notch filtering was clearly audible and that the system destroyed high fidelity. All the publicity that resulted from this state of affairs created much comment in the press and led to many manufacturers getting cold feet. Sony sent their batch of DAT machines to Germany, where release is now imminent. Meanwhile, Sony have bought out CBS Records lock, stock and barrel, and many pundits, myself included, wonder why the release of DAT in the United Kingdom is still not forthcoming. Rumours say that Philips are putting pressure on EEC agencies for a levy on DAT recorders until they themselves are ready to release the new format. Either way, the release of digital audio tape can't be that far off, with United Kingdom hi-fi retailers Laskys claiming this month that they would be one of the first companies selling pre-recorded DAT software at around £14.95 per tape. Now, I've tested both the Sony DTC-1000 ES and the Technics DAT machine, and I can certainly confirm the attraction of the new format. It offers the hi-fi fan a level of recording quality previously only found in recording studios. It gives instant access and the ability to program tracks in the same way as a CD player. Yes, they're all added attractions. DAT is certainly the medium of the future. But exactly when we Europeans will be able to buy players, and more importantly, software, seems to be more a matter of political importance among the Japanese importers. As they say, watch this space.
Interested in improving AM reception? We will be producing a high-performance synchronous detector circuit board, which is designed to greatly improve reception quality of weak or selectively fading AM signals. The board is designed to accept a 455 GHz IF input at any level, so it will suit most communications receivers. There are two selector switches. The first sets the phase lock loop bandwidth, wide, medium or narrow. Where signals are fading rapidly and the carrier phase changes quickly, or where the carrier is phase modulated with data, as on the various long wave services, then the wider loop characteristics must be used. The second switch has six positions. Position 1 is a low distortion envelope detector. Position 2 is normal double sideband synchronous detection. Position 3 gives upper sideband, and position 4 gives lower sideband. Position 5 is called stereo spread, and gives fascinating effects with upper sideband on the left and lower sideband on the right. Position 6 is also unique in giving quadrature, which means that the modulation from the strongest station on the channel is nulled out, so any station beneath can be heard more clearly. Synchronous reception reduces the distortion experienced with a selectively fading signal, but does not help with the objectionable surging in audio level. The final unique feature, then, of this board is that it includes a broadcast quality audio limiter with multiple time constants, which controls the peak audio level. Of course, another benefit of synchronous reception is the signal-to-noise improvement, which results from rejection of noise and interference not in phase with the received signal carrier. The production board will not be ready until July and will be around £150. But if you would like to be on the mailing list for details, send along 1 13-pence British stamp or 1 international reply coupon to Radio Fax, number 1, High Ash Farm, Case Store St. Edmund, England, NR148RH.
From this month's Studio Sound, an article by Barry Fox. Leather on willow, bat upon pad, jolly old cricket, no game for a cad. The odd game of cricket suddenly became very exciting towards the back end of 1987, when English captain Mike Gatting finally lost patience and swore at umpire Shak Hua Rana during the second test at Faizabad. TV viewers not only saw but heard Gatting sounding off. So how were the BBC and ITV able to pick up intelligible conversation from the middle of a cricket pitch? The British TV stations were getting live sound and picture signals by satellite from a Pakistan TV crew, overlaid by BBC or ITV commentaries. At first, the word went round that the TV crews had used a long gun mic to eavesdrop on the wicket. But as time wore on, that theory lost favour. Apart from the difficulty of getting a gun mic long enough to home in on such a distant target, it turns out that Australian cricket promoter Kerry Packer has pioneered a different technique which is now catching on round the world. A small slot is cut out of the turf just beyond the stumps, and a radio mic, for example a Micron, is buried there. This is run at high gain with heavy compression, and it continually broadcasts live sound effects to receivers at the boundary. Batteries are changed during every lunch break. Using a buried mic solves sync problems, because the sound picked up by a distant gun mic would be around 10 frames out of sync with a picture. The buried mic, if anything, is too effective. Unless levels are carefully controlled, it makes leather on willow sound too loud and immediate. Also, the buried mic is too efficient at picking up the sounds of players routinely swearing. This hardly makes for good family entertainment. But it was in the interests of the TV crew to prove that somebody on the pitch was abusive. The wicket mic proved ideal for the job. After the test match, there was much talk of a mystery tape that had captured the whole conversation between Gatting and Rana and proved who swore first. For a while, it looked as if there might well be a rerun of the Nixon-White House tape saga, with audio experts called in to advise cricket experts on whether a tape had or had not been edited to distort the evidence of who swore first, and whether someone's secretary had just happened to erase the vital sections by accident. Sadly, Christmas came to the rescue. As usual, Britain shut down for 2 weeks, and by the time anyone surfaced, only a few people gave a damn anymore for what Gatting and Rana said to each other and who said it first.
From International Broadcast Engineer, SVHS, Claims and Measurements, by Nigel Spratling, from Fortel Incorporated. JVC announced an extended performance version of the 10-year-old VHS system called SVHS, Super Video Home System, in January 87. Finalisation of a PAL-compatible version followed in January 88. The first NTSC-compatible SVHS product became available last autumn, and the range of products available rapidly increased to include not only consumer-oriented equipment, but duplicating machines from JVC and a full range of editing equipment from Panasonic. Claims of resolution in excess of 440 lines, 5.5 MHz, were initially bandied about. These claims have since been toned down to a still incredible 400 lines plus. These claims were tested on a Panasonic AG7500 NTSC edit recorder using composite test signals and YC signals from a new CCD camera called the 300 CLE. Unfortunately, a YC monitor was not available during these tests, so composite signals were fed to a broadcast quality monitor, and the YC output to a tech waveform monitor. With the camera on a resolution chart, the Y output gave around 650 lines on the monitor, which was probably the limiting factor. And astonishingly, the playback from SVHS showed 420 lines definitely visible. The same test made using a Sony BVU870 NTSC resulted in only 280 lines, and that's being kind. Yet more incredible were the results from a sweep input. In the standard play mode, there are two speeds for SVHS. Luma was 4.3 dB down at 5.5 MHz, and in the extended play mode, slower tape speed was only 1.4 dB down. In both cases, the displayed waveform was relatively flat and showed output well beyond 6 MHz. The improvement in performance at a slower tape speed is due to the fact that a wider video track width is available when the tape is slowed, as at normal speeds the video tracks actually overlap and effectively reduce track width by about 30%. In the extended play mode, the track overlap is reduced, and therefore effective track width increased. Crosstalk between tracks is minimized by the same offset azimuth technique employed in standard VHS. A cheap equivalent to Betacam? No, afraid not. The luminance performance of this system is stunning, basically achieved by using much finer particle ferric oxide tape, smaller video head gaps, and shifting the FM luminance carrier. But it is still VHS. Tape handling is the same, and indeed the machine can be switched to play normal VHS recordings. So here is the reality. Chroma is identical to standard VHS. The colour signal is heterodyned down to 629 kHz and crammed into the very bottom end of the tape bandwidth. Users will be lucky if they are able to exceed 400 kHz of chroma from first generation. In making comparisons with 3/4 inch, the first generation performance of SVHF is certainly comparable to BVU. Although the chroma is naturally worse, the subjective results are such that most people around the office chose the NTSC SVHS pictures over the PAL BVU 820 that we were running side by side. As far as audio is concerned, there is no contest. The SVHS equipment uses the same FM audio methods found in the top-end machines available here today. That means a response of 20 Hz to 20 kHz, flat. So, where's the catch? Well, SVHS simply does not stand up to U-matic in generation loss. Third generation SVHS looks horrible if the chroma content is high, colour bars looking just like third generation from normal VHS, and we all know how bad that can be. Still, we mustn't be too critical when taking the price into account. The SVHS Panasonic AG7500 costs $5,900 in the US as compared to around $10,000 for a comparable U-matic. And further improvements are possible. Not mentioned so far has been YC processing. The Japanese partners in the SVHS project are working to encourage consumers to replace all of their home video equipment. There are in excess of 150 million VHS machines in homes around the world, and of course many more TV receivers. The plan is to offer consumers products which replace old equipment and far exceed the original specifications. Sony has been using YC processing for many years, but calls the YC signal a dub signal. A dub connector is found on all modern Sony U-matics. Sony's dub signal is actually two signals, the Y luminance and the chroma signal, still at the colour under frequency required for recording, 685 kHz low band or 984 kHz high band. All users of the U-matic format should be familiar with the benefits of copying or editing programs using the dub signal, as the removal of the encoding and decoding stages also removes the signal degradation caused by these processes. Soon after Sony introduced dub signals, Fortel pioneered the dub process TBC. This product quickly gathered a reputation in the USA for being able to improve the performance of the U-matic system, and the Fortel Y688 is still regarded as the benchmark for dub processing performance. SVHS YC signals differ insofar as the colour signal is at normal subcarrier frequency, 3.5 MHz for NTSC. In the SVHS machine, the colour signal is converted from 629 kHz prior to the YC output. Apart from that, it is essentially the same. In the professional machine, two YC outputs are present, one as described above, and one with the C signal left at 629 kHz. This latter connector is included so that dub recordings can be made with existing industrial VHS equipment. The Japanese consumer has been able for about a year to buy TV receivers and monitors equipped with YC inputs. SVHS-C camcorders are about to follow, as well as standalone cameras with YC connections. The new YC monitors available have a resolution of over 580 lines, allowing the full capability of SVHS to be viewed. Mass video duplication using YC distribution from component sources will provide pre-recorded programming of extremely high quality. Soon, the only pictures with less than 400 lines resolution that the NTSC viewer will have to watch will come from decoded off-air signals. For the professional user, Panasonic is fitting an SVHS YC connector to some M2 models. First generation capture on SVHS with post-production on M2 offers enormous cost savings for news gathering, especially in sensitive areas where equipment is at risk of being destroyed or left behind. Several manufacturers of processing equipment have announced or demonstrated YC products for the program production market, and indeed Fortel has plans to improve the second and third generation chroma performance to a level where it will be comparable with SPU-matic.
Awa, 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 try it like a leg on shine. Awa, awa, quarters in so in his anam shine. Awa, awa, Sibona, Wense, Gaganja. Awa, awa, Amantumbasane.
She's a rich girl, she don't try to hide it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. He's a poor boy, empty as a pocket. Empty as a pocket with nothing to lose. Sing ta-na-na, ta-na-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Ta-na-na, ta-na-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. 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 She's crazy, she got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Well, that's one way to lose these walking blues. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. She was physically forgotten, but then she slipped into my pocket with my car keys. She said, "You've taken me for granted because I please you. Wearing these diamonds." I'm
And I could say, ooh. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. As if everybody here would know exactly what I was talking about. I'm talking about diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Sign of a wave. The poor boy changes clothes and puts on aftershave to compensate for his ordinary shoes. And she said, honey, take me dancing, but they ended up by sleeping in a doorway by the bodegas and the lights on over Broadway, wearing diamonds on the soles of their shoes. And I could say, ooh. And everybody here would know what I was talking about. I mean, everybody here would know exactly what I was talking about. I'm talking about soles of my shoes, yeah. Well, that's one way to lose these walking blues. Diamonds on the soles of my shoes.
Broadcasting to the European Community, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Fax, the trade station. Number 1, High Ash Farm, K-Store St. Edmund, England, NR148RH.
From Airwaves, putting radio at risk. An open letter to the Home Secretary, Douglas Hurd, from Lord Thompson, Chairman of the IBA. On the 19th of January, in a written parliamentary answer, you unveiled the government's proposals for the biggest radio revolution in the history of British broadcasting. As Chairman of the Independent Broadcasting Authority, I applaud your aims but denounce your means. Your proposals for changing the face of commercial radio in this country are radical and imaginative in their objectives, but ill thought out and potentially damaging in their effect, not only on those engaged in independent broadcasting, but on the audiences who listen to it. You want greater choice in both local and national radio. You are responding to the fact that new frequencies are available. Your plans include, at the national level, 3 new radio channels, all for the first time funded by advertising, and at grassroots, several hundred new community stations. Your plans will also incorporate the 50 local commercial stations which reach listeners in some 85% of the country and which have been successfully set up and supervised for 14 years by the IBA. Your proposals to exploit the new frequencies, to provide new national radio choice, and let hundreds of grassroots radio stations flower are exciting and in the spirit of the times. But they are remarkably vague about how the new system will live up to this exciting prospectus. Many important questions are left unanswered, perhaps deliberately. For instance, all our experience of radio supports the case for streamed rather than mixed national channels. Does the government favour mixed channels because it wants to try out a system of competitive tendering for the allocation of frequencies and thinks that mixed channels would make this easier? Or has it some knowledge not shared by the rest of us? What is the timing of introduction of the new national channels and, this is crucial, what frequencies will be released for them by the BBC? Will allocation by competitive tendering really widen listeners' choices, or is it simply a means to take money out of the industry and of programme services into the exchequer? What will the effect of three national channels be on the present ILR services? Can the system of regulation be as light as government claims it will be and still achieve the government objectives regarding the maintenance of standards, regarding impartiality, balance and decency? We believe that there will be a need for a professional and knowledgeable input into the government plans, which must come from those who know radio. This means from all who work in the industry and above all from audiences, the answer should not simply be imposed from on high. There should be a full consultation about what the public want and how the new opportunities may be added without creating financial disaster or chaos. We believe in an evolutionary rather than a revolutionary approach. This is an anti-quango government, so why create a new additional quango to do a job which you have conceded has been very well done by the IBA? It will mean all the expense of a new infrastructure with a new set of officials and new board of members, duplicating what the IBA already provides. Many of the officials will no doubt be drawn from highly professional team forming the radio branch of the IBA, who will be paid redundancy money by the IBA to go on to work for the new radio authority. The political irony is that the IBA, historically, is one of the most ingenious creations of British conservative governments. It was created by the Conservative government of 1954 to break the BBC television monopoly, and this it did brilliantly, setting up the country's first truly regional television system and enriching greatly the choice of British television viewers. It was chosen by the government of 1972 to break BBC radio monopoly, and independent local radio was successfully formed and developed. The ILR stations are the first choice for listening in most of the areas they serve. Then again, the IBA was the chosen instrument of a Conservative government for the establishment of Channel 4, commercially funded but charged by Parliament with being innovative and caring for the minority tastes not previously covered by ITV. And in 1986, the IBA was asked by the government to choose a contractor for Britain's first venture into the world of direct broadcasting by satellite, which will provide viewers with three additional national channels of choice by the autumn of next year. The IBA is one of those British achievements the rest of the world admires and Britain takes for granted. Britain is the only country in the world to have created a public broadcasting system of quality that is wholly commercially funded, receiving not a penny from the broadcast licence. Today, when technology is widening the range of choice for viewers, people come from all over the world to the IBA to find out how Britain does it. The IBA contains the most experienced core of commercial broadcasting regulators in the world. They have shown the professional skill to run different and appropriate regimes for terrestrial television, for local commercial radio, and now for direct broadcasting by satellite. In the detailed practical proposals we have put to the Home Office on its green paper on radio, we have shown we have the experience to make separate and distinctive arrangements, not only for the new national commercial radio channels, but for new community stations, and to run them with a light touch once the new legislation is in place. The IBA is uniquely placed to organise the difficult and delicate transition for the present ILR stations into the new licensing regime proposed by the government. You should not underestimate the risks of financial disaster and chaos if the process is not handled well. Your plan seemed to me to be a recipe for uncertainty, delay, and dislocation, with an outgoing authority on one hand and a new authority still to be born and find its feet. If government and parliament persist in the course currently proposed, the IBA will of course do everything in its power to ensure that the transition is completed with as little damage as possible. But is it right to take these risks? It is perhaps odd that I, as an ex-Labour minister, should have to remind you that the Conservative philosophy has always claimed to seek change with continuity. The IBA could provide both that change and that continuity.
From Electronics and Wireless World, by Pat Hawker, Power Without Wires. Over 20 years ago, in October 1964, at the Spencer Laboratory of Raytheon at Burlington, Massachusetts, a model 6-foot helicopter climbed vertically up a guide wire to a height of 50 feet, powered by microwave energy received on the model from 5 kilowatts of power generated on the ground. This was one of a series of experiments aimed at fulfilling the long sought-after goal of Nikola Tesla to transmit electrical power without wires. The model helicopter project was part of a US defense project aimed at being able to drive a hovering vehicle from the ground as part of a laser communications system above the level of air turbulence. What eventually became of this project has escaped my notice. Now, 23 years later, a Canadian Department of Communications Project SHARP Stationary High Altitude Relay Platform is working along the same ambitious lines. A recent successful flight of an experimental microwave-powered model helicopter with a span of 4 metres has been reported. The model was taken up to about 100 metres with the aid of onboard batteries. These were then turned off, and the model kept aloft by means of 2.5 gigahertz energy beamed up from a dish antenna on the ground. The model is only 1/8 the size of the planned operational helicopter platform, which, when fully developed, is expected to be able to hover at heights up to 20 kilometers for months on end, as a low-cost alternative to satellite communications or regional television services. This is expected to have a 36.5-metre span, a fuselage 24 metres long, and to carry a 9.6-metre dish antenna set up behind the wings. The helicopter and its transponders will be powered from about 12 ground dishes, and it is estimated that up to about 10 kilowatts should be available for onboard communications or broadcast equipment, which could have a service area of up to 600 kilometres diameter. The Canadian Department of Communications plans to spend about $10 million Canadian dollars on the model trials and another $20 million on an operational model, $1 million on the aircraft, $19 million on the ground transmitters. Operating costs are put at about $250,000 annually. It is claimed that the power density of the upgoing microwave beams will not be sufficient to affect birds, hang gliders, ultralight aircraft or balloons.
Now here's a snippet from Lineup about the top people at Tara. A BBC producer and the American behind Laser 558 have been chosen to run the new popular long-wave radio station currently known as Radio Tara. Travis Baxter, currently with BBC Bristol, becomes station director and John Catlett will be a part-time programme consultant. Both will start work in March. Radio Tara, a temporary name, is due to come on the air in autumn with a 500 kilowatt transmitter near Dublin on 254 kHz. It is expected to cover the whole of Ireland and the UK, except London and the South East.
We're on the air to demonstrate the kind of service we will be providing every day of the week, starting during the summer. What we are seeking is a licence to transmit from the United Kingdom, instead of hiring transmission facilities abroad. If you would like our specially printed QSL card, please send 50 pence in British stamps or 3 international reply coupons to Radio Fax No. 1, High Ash Farm, Case Store St Edmund, England, NR14 8RH. And don't forget that every letter we receive helps our application for a licence to transmit from England.
And now to the subject of gear.
And now Roger Tate is going to tell us how to go about buying the exotic receiver you will need to be able to pick up this station.
Getting a second-hand shortwave receiver. There are not many shops that stock shortwave communication sets, but here in the British capital there are a few around. In Wimbledon, to the south of London, is the CQ Centre at Merton Park Parade, where I talked to Paul Thorne and began by asking him what receivers they regularly get in stock.
Well, the things we regularly seem to see on the second-hand market are things like the Yaesu FRG7, the Low SRX30, the Tendi or Realistic DX300, and there are also a lot of the old AR88s around. But with the older receivers, one should take care that spares are available, and if possible that they have a manual and a circuit diagram with them. And you usually tend to find that the older receivers are rather large and cumbersome, but there are always several good models around on the second-hand market.
Right, the AR88 particularly, what sort of price would that sell for in your shop?
Well, these are very good value. I'm a fan of these older valve receivers, but as I say, they are rather large and unwieldy. But a good going price is somewhere around between the £40 and £50 mark, depending on general condition.
Now, the FRG7, that's another very popular receiver. Are there any particularly sort of stock faults that you would, advise people to look at with those?
No, I don't think there are, really. The FRG7s are now a very good value for money. They sell for anything from £130 to £150. There is an ordinary model and there is one with the digital readout. And obviously the one with the digital readout will cost a little bit more. But they are basically a very good general communications receiver.
I was talking to Paul Thorne of the CQ Centre in Wimbledon, South London. It's a long way to use it. It comes and goes. It's a long way to use it. Boy, don't you know. And if you like to lose it, he will show. So don't you ever.
Innovative information-based radio. 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Facts, the trade station. Number 1, High Ash Farm, K-Store St. Edmund, England, NR148RH.
In Sound Engineer and Producer, Roma Fieldstein asks female engineers about career opportunities in music recording. Is it really all jobs for the boys? If you happen to be a female engineer in the music industry, consider yourself very privileged, for you are among a very small minority. The exact number of women engineers is difficult to obtain, but suffice to say that they only just reach two digits. So why are there so few women engineers? Contrary to broadcasting industry, where engineers of both sexes are heavily in demand, the music industry has a plethora of applicants. Simon White, managing director of Marquee Studios, says he gets around 12 applicants a week for one annual vacancy. In the past, few women applied for jobs, but Renata marrying Elton John has changed all that, explains White. The watershed, however, appears to be no more than a tiny trickle. Traditionally, studio bosses felt that women engineers could not do the job, and good many of them still hold this belief. They use excuses such as, it's too physical, the equipment is too heavy. Clients would feel embarrassed by women in sessions. The training is long, then many women leave to have babies, etc. Very much the same excuses used in male-dominated industries for the past century. The BBC, however, has a number of women engineers on its books and makes a concerted effort to employ women in this area. At last year's intake for sound engineer trainees, there were 353 applicants, out of which 185 were women. 35 were accepted, of which 24 were women. John Gibbs, the BBC's manager of operations and studio music, explains that women do better in the selection process because men come in expecting to get the jobs, while women come in fighting. This was not always the case. Bob Neal, head of BBC Engineering and Technical Operations Recruitment, remembers being appalled when he found out that the BBC had a policy of not employing women engineers. I was horrified and quickly worked at getting rid of this policy, he says with genuine concern. We're putting a lot of resources and effort into getting more women into the broadcast operations field. It's more difficult because traditionally girls at 16 don't see science and engineering as career opportunities. To that end, the BBC are offering training for arts graduates. Despite the well-known chauvinism in the music industry, particularly the rock and roll business, not everybody has Renata's luck and marries the boss. It does appear that a few women are applying for the jobs. Which came first, the chauvinism or lack of applicants? It is not clear, although one suspects it was the former. Tim Blackmore, freelance music producer for both radio and television, says that it's hard to find women to fill jobs in the music industry. If we decided we particularly wanted a woman to do the job, it would be exceedingly hard to find one that wasn't already employed. They are few and far between, he says. Having spent a good many years at the BBC, Blackmore has always worked with women in the control room, and it was only when he went into the music industry that he realised that women engineers were a scarce commodity. Sound engineer and producer conducted a mini-survey. A few women engineers preferred not to talk as they felt that the low employment levels were not an issue. Among the others, there was an interesting diversity of opinion. And Charlie Dutt, at 28, house engineer with Battery Studios, part of the Zomba Group, previously worked at Matrix Studios and Rampart Studios as a tape op. She has an electronics degree from University College London. I don't think that making a degree makes any difference in getting into the industry. It doesn't help you to make a better cup of tea. In fact, I didn't tell anyone I had a degree because I thought they might be put off. I walked around every studio in London before I got a job, and it was not so much being a woman that made it difficult. It was more a case of being at the right place at the right time. The hours are very long and the work is strenuous. I went through a period when I stopped working in the music industry because it was too hard on my social life. Gail Lamborn, at 22, assistant engineer at Orinoco, was formerly a tape op at Berry Studios. Before that, she spent 3.5 years with a company that sold sound equipment, where she used only to make up leads and check the equipment. She went to Paddington College to study theatre sound. She says, I've been applying for about 4 years before I got the job at Berry Studios. There's a general lack of jobs around, especially in the studios. Although it has improved for women, it's far from perfect. At interviews, they tend to be put off by women. I've been told many times at interviews they think I can't do the job. At first, you're patronised, but once you show that you are competent, it eases up. I've never had to deal with any sexism in sessions. My advice for women wanting to get in is patience. Stick with it, no matter how much you're being put off at the beginning. Rain Shine is a freelance engineer. She worked as an assistant with Vangelis before becoming an engineer and stayed there for 3 years. Before that, she worked at South Studio as a studio assistant and at Phonogram Records as a telex receptionist. Her first job was in 1977 at a small studio called The Junction. When I was at school, I wrote to the BBC asking to join as a trainee engineer. The official reply said that no women got jobs as engineers. The reason, apparently, was because musicians like to swear, and it was felt that a woman in the studio would inhibit their music. When I left Junction Studio, it was impossible to get another job in the music industry. It was before the Equality Bill, so I was forced to work as a receptionist and telex operator. I used to apply for jobs using only my surname, and when I arrived at the interview, I could tell by their faces that they weren't interested. It's a growing process, and it will take time for women to filter through. They are all probably at the tea-making stage at the moment, which is something that both men and women have to go through. My advice for anyone wanting to come in is to get somebody to support you financially, because the pay at first is very bad. It's also important to be one of the boys, but at the same time, not to lose your femininity, which can be an asset. Arabella Rodriguez, engineer at Britannia Row, started off as a secretary and then married a music publisher. They built their own studios at home where she dabbled and learnt how to work the equipment and to make jingles. She started at Britannia as an assistant engineer, becoming an engineer in November of 1986. She says it's now more accepted to have women as tape operators than it was when I first went into the business. It's the higher you rise that the problems occur, because this is where you traditionally will meet resentment. Rock and roll is a man's world, and there are few women engineers there. I have only ever had one complaint, and that was from a rock and roll band who called up the studio saying they didn't like having a woman engineer. I think that for women wanting to get into the industry, it's just a case of having nothing to fear but fear itself. Candy Robertson is 25 and assistant engineer at Smokehouse Recording Studios. I left school at 17 and worked as a secretary. June this year, I applied for a media course and was advised to train for a sound engineer. I was fortunate and almost immediately accepted for training by Smokehouse. I think that women make good engineers because they complement the men and offer a balance to the music, a sort of yin and yang. Sometimes it's easier for women to see or hear things that men would not notice. This is especially true when working with a female musician. I think we give them a different perspective on the music. I hope to be a full engineer by the end of November. Nikki Townley at 28, freelance engineer, previously worked for 5 years with BFBS and was educated at London University with a degree in drama and French, majoring in technical design. Unfortunately, when I graduated, I missed the intake for training, so instead I took a course at the National Broadcasting School and trained as a sound engineer in radio. I think women tend to make better sound engineers because they can endure intense concentration for longer periods than can men. It's also been proven that women have a better ear for music. I've always worked as the only female in our team of men. I don't know whether some women might find this off-putting. Sadly, there is still a mistaken belief that swearing and general debauchery by men in the music industry is not suitable for women. Certainly, it's a hard life, and the hours are extremely long. But I think the real reason why so few women are in the industry lies with career officers at school and the choices women make at 16 about their future careers. Jane Hancock, at 23, wild track engineer, is just leaving Molinaire after 4 years. She was educated at South Thames College in Wandsworth, where she took a technical course. I started off with 6 weeks' work experience at Molinaire, and they offered me a job. It took me 1.5 years before I became a full-time engineer, and I suffered no hardship at all as being a woman. In fact, in some cases, I think being a woman helps. Certainly, it is no harder for a woman than in any other industry. I think it doesn't occur to women to apply for these kinds of jobs. By far, the biggest problem we have is getting an ACTT ticket. Incidentally, Ron Anderson, senior engineer at Molinaire, will be looking for someone to replace Jane Hancock, so any aspiring women engineers better get their skates on.
Riders on the storm, into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown, like a dog without a bone, an actor out alone. Riders on the storm, there's a killer on the road, his brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday, let your children play. If you give this man a ride, sweet family will die. Killer on the road, yeah. Girl, you gotta love your man. Girl, you gotta love your man. Take him by the hand, make him understand. The world on you depends, our life will never end. Gotta love your man. Yeah.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone. An actor out on loan. Riders on the storm.
Broadcasting to the European community, something completely different on your radio.